Completely fed up and stopped caring, I had on jeans and a white cotton shirt and silver earrings, so that's what I wore. And yes, I'll admit it, nice underwear. I waited on the porch and was relieved when Lloyd pulled up before Emelina's household had roused. It was a little odd, living with a family that paid attention to my social life. Jack stood up to greet me from the back of the pickup truck, and I rubbed his ears. I brought lunch, I told Lloyd, sliding into the cab with a basket Emelina had helped pack the night before. He smiled wonderfully. That's mighty white of you. I didn't know what to make of that. It was something people said, but usually when they said it, both people were white. I asked him to detour past the post office so I could check for mail. There was no regular mail delivery in Grace, probably on humanitarian grounds. A daily route up these stair-step streets would have put some postal employee into a cardiac high-risk category. Every family had a box at the P.O., which they could check daily or annually as they pleased. Emelina leaned toward annual. I persuaded her to turn over the key to me. I was the only member of the household expecting mail. The mailboxes were built right into the outside wall of the post office. I peeked through the little window of the Domingos family drawer and saw the striped margin of an airmail envelope. Hallie, I called to Lloyd, waving the envelope as I bounced back to the truck. He didn't seem to register. My sister, Hallie, in Nicaragua. I checked the postmark to make sure this was true, and it was. Mailed nearly 3 weeks ago. The stamps, two alike, were bright and beautiful, carrying across oceans and continents a childlike revolutionary hopefulness, a painting of a woman picking red coffee beans and her baby strapped on her back. Hallie was in the fields of her dreams. I ripped it open and read quickly. She'd arrived mid-September, was fine, got my letters. She spent a few days in Managua and then backtracked straight to the rural area near Chinandega. She'd expected or feared a little formality, but they put her to work the day she arrived, wearing her one and only dress. I'm in seventh heaven, she wrote, and I could see her hiking up that dress and striding across the plowed rows, leading a battery of stunned men. This cotton, she wrote, has been getting sprayed to death and still eaten up with weevils. Cultivation practices are pitiful. I know exactly what to do. I think we'll get productivity up about 100% from last year. Can you imagine? You'd think it was Christmas. Everybody's already talking about how the collective could use this prosperity. They could get a secondary school teacher in here full time, or a good adult ed program. I got a vivid picture of Hallie's face and could hear her voice as I read. Her hair would be restrained in a red bandana, her face tense with concentration, and her eyebrows knit at angles like accent marks. I could also recall her exact expression as she lay on our living room sofa in Tucson with her long legs propped up, one hand pushing the hair up from her high forehead while she calmly dispensed information over the garden hotline. I understood the full extent to which she'd been wasting her life on houseplants. The letter was short. She was living in a two-room house with a widowed mother of four young children who insisted that Hallie have one of the rooms to herself, a luxury that made Hallie uncomfortable. There was nothing to spare. The day she moved in, a request went out to the neighbors and somebody brought over a plate and tin cup for her, and somebody else brought a fork. Both women had recently lost sons. The territory she would have to cover, giving crop advice, was huge. She was issued a horse. There were problems with the roads, she said, that made jeeps a less desirable mode of transport for short trips. Horses usually weren't heavy enough to trigger the landmines the Contras buried in the roads. The horse's name was Sopa del Dia. She was white with gray spots. She signed it, "You're insane with love, Sister Hallie." With a P.S. Re, your question about botany? Tell your students plants do everything animals do. Give birth, grow, travel around. How do you think palm trees got to Hawaii? Have sex, etc. They just do it a lot slower. Bear this in mind. Flowers are the sex organs of plants. Tell the boys to consider that when they're buying their dates corsages for the prom. And a PPS. Sure, I remember when we almost drowned in a flood. Plain as day. God, Cody, don't you? We found those abandoned coyote pups and the river was flooding and you wanted to save them. You said we had to. I was chicken because Doc Homer would spank the shit out of us and I wanted to run for it, but you wouldn't let me. I told Lloyd, my sister's saving people's lives in Nicaragua. She's a doctor. I thought she was a farmer. People can't live without crops. There's more than one way to skin a revolution. He nodded. I wanted him to know more than this about Hallie, that she was also a human being who did normal things, that she'd tried once, just as an example, to teach Carlo and me to break dance. She'd thrown her hair around like a prissy rock star, and we died laughing. In wool socks on the hardwood floor, she could moonwalk like Michael Jackson. I kept folding and unfolding the letter. She has to ride a horse because there's landmines in the road. The cab of the truck shuddered every time we hit a pothole, but Lloyd drove calmly, his mind far away, the way I imagined he might look riding a horse. I'd never seen him so relaxed. I looked back a few times to check on Jack, who seemed equally content. I presumed he'd walked around in circles a few times back there before curling up in his nest of imaginary tall grass. "Is there anything you know of that you'd die for?" I asked Lloyd. He nodded without hesitation. "What?" He didn't answer right away. Then he said, "The land." "What land?" "Never mind. I can't explain it." "The reservation, like defending your country?" "No." He sounded disgusted. "Not property. I didn't say property."
"Oh."
We passed by another of Black Mountain's mines, abandoned for years, the buildings standing quiet as a shipwreck. The huge windows of the smelter were made of chicken wire glass, but a lot of them were broken out anyway. Inside loomed the dinosaur skeletons of old machinery. Next to the smelter were the concentrator and a hovel of shacks under rusting tin roofs. Beyond them lay more fallow alfalfa fields, their soil crusted white from all the years of slightly salty irrigation water. Hallie could have stayed right in Grace and done some good, but of course there was the question of relative desperation of need. Nobody was dying for lack of this alfalfa. The edge of these fields was the southern border of the Apache Reservation, just 15 minutes north of Grace. I hadn't been there before and was surprised it was that close. "Are you kidding?" he asked. "Grassela Canyon used to be in the reservation. The whites took that little section back after some guys hit gold down there."
"Is that true?"
"Look it up, Einstein. It's in the town records. They only gave the Apache this land in the first place because it looked like a piece of shit." To some extent, that must have been true. It was dead-looking country, though not as dead as the used-up cropland. It didn't look murdered. Here, the gentle hills were pale brown grading to pink, sparsely covered with sage and fall-blooming wildflowers. Along the creek beds were tall stands of cottonwoods. Their yellow leaves rained down. Every now and then, we'd pass through clusters of homes that you couldn't exactly call towns, with long horse corrals strung between the houses. Red horses raised their heads and galloped along beside us for the short distance they'd been allotted, expertly turning aside just before they reached the ends of their corrals. Lloyd waved at the people we passed, and they waved back. "Do all those people know you?" I asked, incredulous.
"Nah, just my truck."
Eventually, we stopped in one of the settlements that was distinguished from the others by its size and the presence of a store. Rusting soft drink signs nailed across the front porch marked it as a commercial establishment. Through the screen door, I could see shadows of men in cowboy hats. Lloyd pulled his parking brake, squeezed my hand, and held on to it for a second. "You want to come in?" he asked doubtfully. "It's only going to take me 10 minutes." "I know what this is about," I said. "JT told me you're into fighting cocks." He nodded slightly. "Well, is it okay for me to go in with you? Are women allowed?" He laughed, then dropped my hand and flipped his index finger against my cheek. "Big old rooster-fighting Indian boogeyman might get you." "I'm a big girl," I said. I got out and followed him up the wooden steps, but regretted it once we were inside. A short man leaning on the counter looked at Lloyd and resettled his hat on his head, ignoring me completely. This wasn't going to be any of my business. I bought a lukewarm soft drink from the old guy behind the counter. He grasped it through his apron and screwed off the cap, leaving a broad asterisk of dust on the white cloth. The other men watched this gesture in silence. "I'll be outside," I told Lloyd. I sat in a wooden rocker on the porch. Jack had lifted his head and cocked his ears but hadn't moved from the truck bed. Almost immediately, I could hear Lloyd raising his voice. "I told you I want Apodaca's line and not any of the others. I want gaffers. I'm not interested in knife birds." The short man said, "Lloyd, I'm telling you, you got to go up to Phoenix. They're getting goddamn tourists at those knife tourneys. It's a circus. You can get 200 birds through there in a day." "Don't tell me what I want. Do you have gaffers out there, or did I just waste a tank of gas?" Their voices dropped lower again. I felt uncomfortable listening in, though I was fascinated and slightly appalled by the notion of knife birds. It was encouraging that Lloyd didn't want them, whatever they were. The words the men used were as mysterious as Lloyd's railroad talk. He evidently spoke a lot of languages, not even counting Apache and Pueblo and Navajo. Across the street from the store stood a substantial-looking whitewashed church, the only white building in an adobe town. It was shaped like the Alamo with a bell tower. The ground in front was planted with petunias, phlox, and marigolds, pink, purple, orange, in that order. One thing Hallie always said she loved about Indian reservations and Mexico was that there were no rules about color. She was right. It was really a splendid combination now that I looked at it. But in some orderly country like Germany, they'd probably arrest you for planting this in front of your house. In suburban Tucson, they'd just avoid you. Keep their kids inside when you went out to weed. People trailed out of the church in twos and threes, mostly women, carrying out the same color scheme in their blouses and skirts. They all looked at me as they passed, not with hostility, but with the kind of curiosity you'd have if you noticed an odd plant had popped up in your garden. You wouldn't yank it out right away. You'd give it a few days to see what developed. I could hear roosters cock-a-doodling somewhere, and I was curious. As I went down the steps, an adobe-colored dog scooted out of my way and ran under the porch. The store, I discovered, had a deep backyard. The chain-link fence was overgrown with weedy vines, but I could still see in. It was a rooster garden in there. Roosters in small cubicles laid out in neat rows, one bird per cage. They strutted and turned in circles, eyeing each other as if each moment were new, as if they hadn't, for all their natural lives, been surrounded by these other birds. They had red faces and glossy black feathers that threw off iridescent flashes of color, like a hummingbird's throat. Beautiful, but the claustrophobic energy was tiring to watch. I heard a door slam, and I quickly went back around front. Lloyd was ready to go, but not in the bad mood I expected. By the time we got to the edge of town, he was smiling. I offered him the last of my soda. "So, did you waste a tank of gas?" He put his arm across the back of the seat, his thumb touching the nape of my neck, and shot me a sideways look. "No way." We weren't headed back toward Grace. We drove north. There were no more towns, just reddish hills and a badly rutted road. Was that White River? I asked.
No, this is what you'd call the White River metropolitan area.
You used to live here after you left your mother's pueblo?
Around here. We lived up at Ghost River.
It's a little higher ground up there. It's nice. There's trees.
You and your dad, and I wanted to ask about his dead twin brother, but then again, I didn't. Not today.
And Jack, he said.
Whatever happened to Jack's coyote mother?
After she had her litter, she left us. She went back to live in God's backyard.
I was quiet for a minute, taking in the hills.
And where are we headed now?
He smiled. Who wants to know?
A hometown girl looking for some adventure.
Well, then, we're headed for some adventure.
Lloyd kept both hands on the wheel in the washed-out stretches, driving like a race car driver. I don't mean fast, but skillfully, with that generous kind of concentration that seems easy as a reflex. We were gaining ground, getting higher, passing through intermittent stands of evergreens. In between were meadows, solidly carpeted in yellow flowers, punctuated by tall white poppies with silver leaves and tissue paper petals. In the distance, the southern slopes of the mountainsides were dappled with yellow. We passed through another tiny enclave of houses and horse corrals. The people there would have been born into that life. I couldn't imagine it. For some reason, I thought of Hallie's first letter, the babies playing around the cook fire in the refugee camps. But this wasn't like that. It didn't look desperate, just lonely. It was hard to understand why a person would stay. Lloyd hadn't, but then again, he wasn't born here. And yet he seemed drawn back for reasons beyond fighting cocks. The road smoothed out a bit, and Lloyd took his right hand off the wheel and laid it on my leg. For a little while, he and I both pretended it wasn't there. Then I asked him, "What would these people around here say if they knew you had your hand on a white girl's thigh?" He smiled. "They'd say I was a lucky son of a bitch." He lifted the hand and ran his palm up the length of my arm, from my wrist to my shoulder, lightly, just stroking the hairs and not the skin. My nipples stood up and my scalp tingled and my whole body wanted that hand on it, everywhere at once. But he took it back and put it on the steering wheel, and I pitied myself for envying a steering wheel. "You still haven't told me where we're going," I said. He nodded at the road. "That's where we're going. We're almost there." After a minute, he geared down into four-wheel drive and turned off the dirt road onto a side path. Not really a road, but a pair of tracks in the gravelly ground. If you hadn't known it was there, you'd never have seen it. "If we are going to see some more people about gaffers and knife birds," I thought, "I'm going to have to sit and be still, be a white girl. No matter what, I'm going to have to stop thinking about kissing Lloyd." I looked away from his face out the window. There was nothing out there now but fields of yellow flowers, rocky red hills in the near distance, and off to the east, very high mountains, softly blackened around their tops by a pelt of pine forests. It would be cool up there now, even today. I pictured myself lying under the pines on a floor of brown needles. It was hard to keep Lloyd out of the picture. "What is this?" I was out of the truck, entranced, before he'd even set the brake. "Kanishba," Lloyd said. "Prehistoric condos." That's just about what it looked like. Out there in the middle of God's backyard, without a fence in sight, sat a long rectangular building made entirely of carefully set stone, no mortar. Dozens of small doors opened into it across the front. "Can we go inside? Is it allowed?" He hooked his elbow around my neck like a friendly wrestler as we walked toward the site. "It's allowed. I allow it." "What, are you the landlord here?" "Till somebody tells me I'm not." He let me go and turned toward the truck, whistling once. Jack leaped in a high arc over the tailgate and streaked through the field of foot-tall grass, looking like the soul of happiness. He headed downhill toward what must have been a river. I could see cottonwoods.
We were in higher country here with more vegetation.
That's a good dog, I said.
Yep, that's a good dog. The doors were no more than 4 feet high. I ducked through one into a small rectangular room with a dust floor. It was cool as a cave and quiet. The door was a square of bright light with the silhouette of Lloyd coming through. Even inside the room, the ceiling was low, just inches above my head. I touched it. People were short back then, I said. Didn't eat their Wonder Bread.
They would have had to build a special room for you. You would have been their queen.
I laughed, though it struck me I'd been complimented. Was that how Lloyd saw me? Not as a grain elevator on the prairie, but a queen. At the back of the room, a door led into another room which was darker, having no openings to the outside. Two more doors led out of that room, one to the side and one up through the ceiling, which was made of thick, curved trunks of small trees. There was another whole set of rooms on top of this one.
Can we go upstairs? I asked.
He shook his head. I wouldn't trust those beams. They're kind of old.
How old?
800 years. I looked at him.
Are you kidding?
Nope. We went from room to room, changing directions in the dark until the compass points were entirely lost to me. It was a maze. Lloyd said there were more than 200 rooms, a village under one roof. The air smelled cold. I tried to imagine the place populated. Stepping from room to room over sleeping couples, listening through all the noises of cooking and scolding and washing up for the sound of your own kids, who would know secret shortcuts to their friends' apartments.
The walls are thick, I observed.
The walls are graveyards, he said. When a baby died, they'd mortar its bones right into the wall or under the floor.
I shuddered.
Why? So it would still be near the family, he said, seeming surprised I hadn't thought of this myself. Without warning, we came out into a bright courtyard in the center, surrounded by walls and doorways on all four sides. It was completely hidden from the outside, a little haven with a carpet of fine grass and an ancient ash tree. A treasure island. I was drawn to the shade.
We should have brought the picnic basket, I said, settling under the ash. The ground was cool.
My brief vision of a living city was gone. It seemed ghostly again. For 800 years, those bones in the walls had been listening to nothing more than the dry skittering of lizards.
We've got all day, Lloyd said.
He sat about 2 feet away from me, clasping his hands around his knees and looking at the toes of his boots.
So who built this place 800 years ago?
My mama's folks, the Pueblo. They had their act together back then, didn't they?
They did.
I couldn't stop running my eyes over the walls and the low, even roofline. The stones were mostly the same shape, rectangular, but all different sizes. There would be a row of large stones, and then two or three thinner rows, then a couple of middle-sized rows. There was something familiar about the way they fit together. In a minute, it came to me. They looked just like cells under a microscope.
It doesn't even look like it was built, I said. It's too beautiful. It looks like something alive that just grew here.
That's the idea. Lloyd seemed as pleased as if he'd built it himself.
Of what? The idea of Pueblo architecture?
Yep. Don't be some kind of a big hero. No Washington monuments. Just build something nice that Mother Earth will want to hold in her arms.
It was a pleasant thought. I also didn't mind the thought of being held in Lloyd's arms, but he was making no moves in that direction.
He was explaining the water system. They evidently had some sort of running water, and how they'd grown squash and corn on the hillside facing the river.
I reached over and ran a finger from his knee to his ankle.
He looked up.
I'm talking too much, right?
I shook my head.
No, keep talking.
You sure?
I hesitated. I hadn't expected to have to make the suggestion, and my stomach felt tight.
Yeah, just could you move over here and talk?
His eyes brightened. I'd taken him by surprise. He leaned over, and I took his head in my hands and gave him the kiss I'd been thinking about for the last 2 hours. It lasted a good long while. He twisted his fingers gently through the hair at the base of my skull and held on tight, and my breath stopped while he laid down a track of small kisses from my earlobe to my collarbone. We lay back on the grass, and I rolled against him, looking down into his eyes. They were dark brown, a color with depth to it, like stained glass. It was a little surprising to look at brown eyes after all the pale blues of Grace. Just being held felt unbelievably good, the long drink I'd been dying for. For a second, I hugged back as tightly as I could. Something inside his buttoned shirt pocket made a crackling cellophane sound. I raised up a little and poked it with my finger. "If you've got a condom in your pocket, Lloyd Peregrina, this is my lucky day." He did. It was. By late afternoon, the shade had moved, and we had also rolled over a few times in the grass, I suppose, traveling from our original spot. Anyway, we were in the sun. We disconnected, and I lay on my back, feeling the forbidden touch of sun on my nipples and eyelids. Lloyd lay with his head propped on his elbow, just looking at me again, the way he had on the day of Emelina's party. With a finger, he traced concentric circles around my breasts and triangles on my abdomen, as if war-painting me for some ceremonial mission. Whatever it might be, I felt up to the job. I knew when reason returned, I'd be scared to death of feeling that good with another person, but my body was renewed. I felt like a patch of dry ground that had been rained on. Jack had come into the courtyard and was sleeping in the shade a little distance away. "He found his way in here without any trouble," I said. "You boys must come here a lot." Lloyd kissed my cheek and sat up and pulled on his jeans. "Yep, kind of a lot. Not as much as I'd like to." I thought of the condom in his pocket, the presumption, and felt irritated. "Well," I said, "it's a good seduction spot. It worked on me." I found the rest of my clothes and concentrated on getting my shirt buttoned up. I'd lost an earring somewhere. Lloyd stared at me for a full half minute and then lay back down, his hands clasped behind his head, looking straight up. "I don't mean that I bring people here. Nobody but me and Jack's ever been here before." He glanced at me and then away again. "But I guess that's just what you'd expect me to say." He didn't say anything more for another minute, and then he said, "Shit." "I'm sorry. I guess I believe you. I do believe you." He was wounded. I suppose some sharp thing in me wanted to sting him for making me need him now. After he'd once cut me to the edge of what a soul will bear. But that was senseless. Anybody would say that baby was my own fault, and he didn't even know about it. I looked at this grown-up Lloyd and tried to make sense of him, seeing clearly that he was too sweet to survive around me. I would go to my grave expecting the weapon in the empty hand. "Cody," he said, "I couldn't believe it when you said you'd come up here with me. I couldn't even believe I'd asked." I sat forward, letting the point of my chin dig into my knee. "I can see what it means to you. I'm sorry for thinking what I did." He spoke slowly. "I've been looking forward to this ever since Labor Day. Not because I thought we'd not for any one reason. I just wanted to come here with you." I looked at him. It was the truth. I could think of nothing at all to say. "I don't blame you if you're still pissed off at me for when we were in high school." My heart lost its rhythm for a second. "What for?" "For being a jerk." "You remember that?" I suppose it was an insulting question. He said,
I have a lot of reasons in my mind for the way I was, but they don't make much difference. I hurt a lot of people.
I looked at him carefully. In what way exactly do you think you hurt me?
He shrugged. Well, maybe I didn't. Maybe you didn't care, but still, I could have been a lot nicer. We went out those couple of times, and then so long, sucker, that's it. Lloyd's a good time boy. He don't call the same girl twice.
I breathed out. Nobody knew, so Lloyd couldn't. But for 1 minute, I'd been afraid. I didn't want him to know how much of a mark his careless love had made on my life. It would oblige him to one of two mean possibilities, compulsory kindness or a vanishing act. I leaned over and kissed him. You're forgiven, I said. Plain Jane forgives Mr. High School Honcho for being a red-blooded boy. Plain Jane my ass, he said, rolling me over on top of him and grabbing mine. I like you a lot, a real whole lot. You buy that?
I'll buy it. Just don't try to sell me no knife birds.
He looked straight into my eyes.
I'm serious, Cody.
Okay, I said. Sold. I laid my head on his chest and nearly went to sleep while he gently stroked my spine. I felt like a baby being coaxed reluctantly into dreamland. A few yards away, Jack was already there. His legs jerked helplessly, making him look vulnerable. I've lost an earring, I said. You see it?
No. I'll help you look in a minute.
What's Jack dreaming about?
Chasing rabbits, Lloyd said.
That's what everybody says, but I don't think all dogs dream about that. You watch a city dog that's never even heard of a rabbit, it'll do the same thing.
How do you know they really dream?
They do, I said. All mammals that have been tested have REM sleep, except spiny anteaters. I cringed after I said this. I sounded like Cody Nolene, brain of the 7th grade, despised by her peers.
Spiny anteaters, he said.
Well, I'm sorry, but it's the truth. I read it in the encyclopedia one time.
You are an amazing person.
He meant it. He wasn't making fun of me. His hand stopped moving and came to rest on the small of my back. He was actually thinking about all this. Carla wouldn't have paid the slightest attention to a conversation like this. He'd be thinking about whatever men think about, how much gas is left in the tank. Lloyd asked, "What do you think animals dream about?"
"I don't know," I said. "Animal heaven?" I laughed.
"I think they dream about whatever they do when they're awake. Jack chases rabbits, and city dogs chase, I don't know what, meter readers."
"But that's kind of sad. Couldn't a dog have an imagination like a person?"
"There's nothing sad about it. People dream about what they do when they're awake. God, when I used to work for Tia, sorting the pecans, I'd go to bed and dream about pecans, pecans, pecans."
I studied his face.
"Didn't you ever dream you could fly?"
"Not when I was sorting pecans all day."
"Really, though, didn't you ever fly in your dreams?"
Even I had done that, though not often.
He said, "Only when I was real close to flying in real life. Your dreams, what you hope for and all that, it's not separate from your life. It grows right up out of it."
"So you think we all just have animal dreams? We can't think of anything to dream about except our ordinary lives?"
He gently moved a lock of hair out of my eyes.
"Only if you have an ordinary life. If you want sweet dreams, you got to live a sweet life."
"Okay," I said, feeling happy. I was sure no other man I'd ever known would have concerned himself with what animals dream about. "I'm going to sleep now," I said, "and I'll give you a report." I settled my head back down on his chest. His heartbeat moved faintly against my ear as I looked out across the ground. I saw my silver earring gleaming in the grass.
Homero.
Chapter 13. Crybabies. His name is gone. He understands that this is his own fault. He took a pen to paper and changed it, canceled his ancestors, and now his grandchild, Cody's child, has been erased like something in writing, too, rather than flesh and blood. He knows she's no longer carrying it. He's aware of the signs. The red darkroom light burns like a dying sun, very old. Red dwarfs, they call them, when they reach that stage. He sometimes reads astronomy now when he can't sleep. But at this moment, outside this sealed room, it's daytime. He considers carefully the time of day and of year and his daughter's ages, a ritual he performs a dozen times daily to keep himself rooted in time. That was nearly 20 years ago, when Cody lost the baby. He has photographed the eyes of so many babies. He gets lost among years now, the way he used to lose track when he sat in the dark movie theater for too many hours. He has always loved the dark. The liquid feels cool on his hands, though it's a chemical bath, not particularly good for the elasticity of human skin. He should use the Piper forceps from the kitchen, but he has misplaced them. He moves the photograph into the fixative and stares at the lines and frowns. They are a precise copy of what the real world offered his camera, and nothing more. The branched shadow of a cane cholla falling across a square of pale, cracked ground. He found the image while walking in the arroyo and immediately saw the illusion he could draw out of it, a river in the desert. He'd seen exactly this sight in aerial view. It was years ago, in wartime. They had taken him in a small plane over the bombing range near Yuma. A soldier lay wounded out there and couldn't be moved. They flew the quickest route over the Algodones Dunes, a dead ocean of undulating sand. The pilot said it was harder to fly over dunes on a hot day than through a tornado. The plane shuddered until its rivets creaked. Then suddenly they were over the Colorado River agricultural plain. He marveled, feeling lucky as a spaceman. Surely no one had ever seen this amazing sight, a complex river fretted with canals cutting an unearthly path through the bone-dry land. He can't remember the wounded soldier. He closes his eyes and tries, but he can't. Possibly some chest wound, a punctured lung? No, he can't bring the soldier back. But he remembers the vision of that water. He gently agitates the photograph in its stop bath, lost in technical possibilities. He knows there must be a way to transfigure this cactus shadow into that other vision, which no longer exists outside his mind. All his photographs begin in his memory. That is the point. He might be the only man on earth who can photograph the past. He stops suddenly, feeling a presence outside the door. Cody? He listens. I'm printing. It will be a few more minutes. Cody, are you there? He hears nothing. It's a Monday morning. She can't be here. She's teaching school. He drops the print into the fixer, annoyed, and goes back to the enlarger to try again. He should lock that door to guard against accidents. What a shock that would be to the girls, a locked door. They have always had rules about this. A closed door is a sacred thing. Privacy is respected. There is no call for bolted doors in the Nolin household. But she still locked him out. She was in the bathroom that night for more than 4 hours. When he walked by, he could see that the upper bolt was turned. She'd gone in right after dinner. There are rules about this. Cody? He listens again, but there is no sound at all. He knocks. I just want to know that you're all right. I'm all right. She is crying softly. I can hear that you're crying, he says. Your sister is concerned. You could just tell us what's wrong.
Nothing's wrong. I'm just a crybaby. You're always telling me I'm a crybaby, so you're right.
That isn't true. He doesn't use that word. He tells them they should try to be grown-up girls, but he hasn't needed to tell them that for years. In another minute, she calls out quietly, "Is Hallie out there? I need to talk to her."
Hallie is in her room, reading. She doesn't seem especially concerned. Cody has been so moody of late that Hallie leaves her alone. They don't argue, but there is a new distance between them, a gulf. Cody crossed over into adolescence, leaving Hallie behind for the time being. They both seem lost. All three of them, really. A marooned family, shipwrecked on three separate islands. Before, when the girls were close, he worried about what would happen when they lost each other. Now they have. "Hallie?" He stands in the doorway to their room and repeats her name quietly. "Hallie?" She is reading in poor light, ruining her eyes. She looks up, her eyes nearly marble white under the small, high-intensity lamp above her head. "Your sister has asked for you. Can you please find out what she needs?" She puts her open book face down on the bed and gets up without a word. The two of them confer through the bathroom door. He tries to hear their whispers from the kitchen. He sees that Cody is not letting her in. "The black one, that old one that was mother's." Hallie is gone for only a minute, then comes back. "I can't find it. I got your green jacket."
"No."
Cody says something else that he can't hear. He washes the cast iron skillet and sets it on the stove on low heat to drive out the moisture. He goes into the living room where he can't see but can hear better. Hallie glances up as he walks past her in the hall, and she lowers her voice.
"Why do you have to have that exact sweater, Cody? Are you going outside? It's not even cold."
"Just bring me the black sweater. I mean it, Hallie. Find it. It's in the bottom of one of my drawers." After a long while, Hallie comes back with it. He hears the bolt slide back, then lock again. The door was not open even for a full second. Hallie returns to her reading. In another 15 minutes, he hears scrubbing. She is cleaning the floor. The toilet has flushed more than 24 times. There are rules concerning all these things. Much later, he watches without lamplight from the living room. The house is dark. Her curtain of hair falls as she leans out, looking down toward the kitchen. She comes out. The small bundle in her arms she carries in the curl of her upper body, her spine hunched like a dowager's, as if this black sweater weighed as much as herself. When he understands what she has, he puts his knuckle to his mouth to keep from making a sound. Quiet as a cat, she has slipped out the kitchen door. He follows her down to the arroyo. She takes the animal path that cuts steeply down the bank. Round volcanic boulders flank her, their surfaces glowing like skin in the moonlight. She is going down to the same dry river where they nearly drowned 10 years ago in the flood. This tributary carved out Tortoise Canyon. It would be the Tortoise River if it had a name, but it never runs. It did years ago when he was a boy, hiking these banks to escape his mother's pot-black kitchen, but now it does not run except during storms. The land around Grace is drying up. He stands 100 yards away from Cody, above her, in the shadow of cottonwood trees. She has reached the spot where the rock bank gives over to the gravel and silt of riverbed. Even in the semi-dark, there is a clear demarcation where the vegetation changes. She stoops down into the low acacias, and he can see nothing but her back to him, her bent spine through the sleeveless cotton blouse. It is a small white square, like a handkerchief. In better light, he could photograph it and make it into that, or into a sheet on a clothesline. It's shaking just exactly that way, like a forgotten sheet left out in the windstorm. She stays kneeling there for a long time, being whipped like that. Then her head pushes up through the fringe of acacias, and she moves toward him, her face shining beautifully with its own privacy of tears. He sees how deeply it would hurt her if she understood what he knows, that his observations have stolen the secrets she chose not to tell. She is a child with the dignity of an old woman. He moves back up through the cottonwoods and into the house, into his workroom. He can't know who she has buried down there, but he can mark the place for her. At least he can do that, to save it from animals. Before he goes to bed, he'll cover it with a pile of stones, the heaviest he can move. He pretends for a long time to be busy in his workroom, periodically coming out to feign a need in the kitchen. Where has he put the Piper forceps? Cody is emptied out and exhausted and still stays up half the night doing homework. 6 volumes of the Britannica lie open on the kitchen table. She states that she is doing a report on the marsupial mammals. So many times he comes close to speaking, but the sentences take absurd forms in his mind. I notice that you've been pregnant for the last 6 months. I meant to talk with you about this earlier. He would sell his soul to back up the time. But even if he could do that, could begin where he chose, he can't locate the point where it would have been safe to start. Not 10 weeks ago or 10 years. If he has failed his daughters, he's failed them uniformly. For their whole lives, since Alice died, they've been too far away to touch. It's as if she pulled them with her through a knothole halfway into the other world, and then at the last minute left them behind, 2 babies stranded together in this stone-cold canyon. He can't think of anything more to do in the kitchen, and she's still working. There are dark depressions under her eyes, like thumbprints on her white face. She tells him she has a headache, asks for aspirin, and he goes immediately to the closet where he keeps the medications. He stands for a long time staring at the bottles and thinking. Aspirin would increase the bleeding if she's still hemorrhaging, which is likely from the look of her. But he would know if she were in danger, he tells himself. It was probably uncomplicated, as stillbirths go. It would have been extremely small, even at 6 months. She is so malnourished, he could have predicted toxemia, even placenta abruptio. He continues to stare into the closet, tapping a finger against his chin. He can't even give her Percodan. It contains aspirin. Demerol. That for the pain. Something else for the cramping. What? He wishes he could give her a shot of Pitocin, but doesn't see how he can. He returns to the kitchen and hands her the pills with a glass of water. 4 pills, 2 yellow and 2 blue, when she's only asked for aspirin. But she swallows them without comment, one after another, without looking up from her books. This much she'll take from him. This is the full measure of love he is qualified to dispense. He bends down again over the developer bath, his face so near the chemicals that his eyes water. The picture slowly gives up its soul to him as it lies in the pan, like someone drowned at the bottom of a pool. It's still the same. Plain shadows on dust. Damn. What he is trying for is the luminous quality that water has, even dark water seen from a distance. There is a surface on it he just can't draw out of these dry shadows. He straightens up, his eyes still running, and pats his pockets for his handkerchief. He locates it finally in the wrong pocket and blows his nose. He has manipulated this photograph in every possible way, and none of it has yielded what he wants. He sees now that the problem isn't in the development. The initial conception was a mistake. He He fails in the darkroom so seldom that it's hard for him to give up, but he does. For once, he lets go of the need to work his will. He clicks off the old red dwarf and turns on the bright overhead light, and the unfixed prince lying in the bath all darkened to black. It doesn't matter. The truth of that image can't be corrected. Cosima. Chapter 14. Day of the Dead. On the last Monday of October, Rita Cardinal made three announcements to the class. She was quitting school. This was her last day. And if anybody wanted her fetal pig, they could have it. It was good as new. We'd plowed right through the animal kingdom in record time, having had nothing to look at in the way of protozoans. We'd made a couple of trips back to the river and had given due attention to the amphibians and Mr. Badfish, whose glass home grew more elaborate with each field trip and was now called the Frog Club Med. There were fern palm trees and a mossy golf green, and the frogs obligingly did high-impact aerobics all over everything. Now we were up to exploring the inner mysteries of an unborn mammal, which had to be purchased mail order. But Rita hadn't had the stomach to cut into hers, and I couldn't blame her, all things considered. She was expecting twins. She said she was dropping out because she felt too tired to get her homework done. I feared for these children's future. Rita wore about half a dozen earrings in one ear and had a tough cookie attitude, and I liked her. She'd been a good student. She seemed sorry to go, but also resigned to her fate in that uniquely teenage way of looking at life, as if the whole production were a thing inflicted on young people by some humorless committee of grown-ups with bad fashion sense. I was disappointed but unsurprised to lose Rita. I'd been watching her jeans get tight. The pregnancy dropout rate in Grace was way ahead of motor vehicle accidents as a teenage hazard. Rita was a statistic. On Tuesday, I made my own announcement. We were doing an unscheduled unit on birth control. The reaction in the ranks was equal parts embarrassment and amazement. You'd think I'd suggested orgies in study hall. There was some hysteria when I got to the visual aids. "Look, there's nothing funny about a condom," I said, pretending to be puzzled by their laughter. "It's a piece of equipment with a practical purpose, like a..." Only the most unfortunate analogies came to mind. Shower cap. Tea cozy. "Like a glove," I said, settling for the cliché. I turned from the blackboard and narrowed my eyes. "If you think this thing is funny, you should see the ridiculous piece of equipment it fits over." The guys widened their eyes at each other, but shut up. I was getting the hang of this. "Miss," said Ramo. They'd never learned to call me Cody. "What is it?" "You're gonna get busted for this." I finished my diagram, which looked somewhat more obscene than I would have liked. I brushed my chalk dusty hands on my jeans and hopped up to sit on the tall lab bench that served as my desk. "I know some of your parents might not be too thrilled about this field of study," I said, thinking it over. "I didn't get permission from the school board, but I think we better take a chance. It's important." "Okay, then tell us something we don't know," said Connie Munoz, who had even more holes punched in her left ear than Rita. I wondered if this was some kind of secret promiscuity index. "Shut up, Connie," said Marta. Pearl studs, one per earlobe. "My dad would kill me if he thought I knew this stuff." "What you do is between you and your dad," I said. "Or not. Whatever. But what you know is my business. Obviously, you don't need to put everything you know into practice, just like you don't have to go spraying the fire extinguisher around because you know how to use it. But if your house is already on fire, kiddos, I don't want you burning down with it just because nobody ever taught you what was what." Ramo shook his head slowly and said again, "Busted." He drew the laugh he wanted. "You know what, Ramo?" I asked, tapping a pencil thoughtfully against my teeth.
"What?"
"It doesn't matter a whole lot what the school board thinks." This dawned on me forcefully as I said it. I understood this power. Telling off my boss at the 7-Eleven, for example, 2 days before I left Tucson. The invulnerability of the transient. "There's nobody else to teach this course," I said, "and I only have a 1-year contract, which I wasn't planning on renewing anyway. I'm not even a real teacher. I've just got this provisional certification deal, so that's the way it is. We're studying the reproductive system of higher mammals. If I'm offending anybody's religion or moral turpitude here, I apologize, but please take notes anyway, because you never know." They were completely quiet. But toward the end of the day, you really can't tell what that means. It could be awe or brain death. The symptoms are identical. "Miss?" It was Barbara, a tall, thin, shy student, ears unpierced, whose posture tried always to atone for her height. She'd latched on to me early in the semester as if she'd immediately sniffed out my own high school persona. She asked me now, "You aren't coming back next year?" "Nope," I said. "I'm out of here, just like a senior. Only difference between you and me is I don't get a diploma." I gave them an apologetic smile, meant for Barbara especially. "It's nothing personal. That's just my modus operandi." The kids blinked at this, no doubt wondering if it was a Latin name they needed to write down. "Your modus operandi is the way you work," I said. "It's what you leave behind when you split the scene of a crime." At Grace High, I taught Biology 1, Biology 2, 2 study halls, and I also pinch-hit an algebra class for a fellow teacher who was frequently absent on account of a tricky pregnancy. My favorite class was Biology 2, my seniors, Ramo and Marta and Connie Munoz and Barbara. But on that day, I had a mission and didn't discriminate among souls. I gave everybody the lecture on baby prevention. Barbara, who was in my study hall and also in the algebra class, got to hear it 3 times, poor child, and I imagine she was the least in need. It surprised me as much as the kids, this crusade, and I suspected my motives. What did I care if the whole class had twins? More likely, I wanted to be sure of a terminal contract. After the last bell rang, I erased the blackboard and stood for a minute sharing the quiet with the bones of my Illinois compatriot, Mrs. Josephine Nash. Our day was over. She gave me her silent, wide-jawed smile. Here was a resident of Grace who had never hurt me in childhood, didn't make me rack my memory for her name, she wore it on her pelvis, had thrown no spitballs at me nor asked for extra credit, and didn't suggest that I belonged in Paris, France, or a rock and roll band. From the back of the room, I could hear the frogs clicking against the sides of their terrarium, constant as a clock, up and down, exposing soft white bellies. This time next year, there would not even be fish or frogs in the river. These particular representatives of the animal kingdom were headed for extinction. Whoever taught this class would have to write Carolina Biological Supply and order those stiff-preserved frogs that smell of formaldehyde. Their little feet splayed like hands and their hearts exposed. I stood over the terrarium and peered down into it from above like a god. The fish hung motionless in its small lake. Droplets of condensation were forming on the underside of the glass top, getting ready to rain in there. I'd grown fond of this miniature world, along with the kids, and had added my own touches. A clump of bright red toadstools that popped up in Emelina's courtyard, and a resurrection fern from the cliff behind my house. The terrarium was like a time capsule. I think everybody was trying to save little bits of Grace. I slid the glass to one side, hating to disrupt the ecosystem but needing to feed the fish. The humid smells of mud and moss came up to meet my nose, and I thought of Hallie in the tropics. What would she do about these troubles if she were here? Well,